Ladies and gentlemen, this is hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts, particularly if the radiation levels in New Zealand are so high that you have a part-time job as an eco light bulb. And my very special guest is Karen Hudez, the one who exposed the hubris of the World Bank. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Vinnie.
Can we get into the Jesuits now? What are the Jesuits?
They are the military arm of the Vatican. And they have been thrown out of, I think, about 80 countries. And they were thrown out of the United States after they finished assassinating Lincoln. But guess who brought them back? Ronald Reagan.
Why did he do that?
Well, you know, there's speculation that he was never the same after that assassination attempt on his life. Some people
Hold on a second. Let me get this straight. He was traumatized after getting nearly assassinated, so he invites assassins into his country to make himself feel better.
Some people say that the Ronald Reagan that emerged after that assassination attempt had been programmed.
Has he got any personal history in the background? Were you Jesuit training as a child or anything like that?
No, but he was nearly dead, and some people said that, you know, what happened was a puppet after he came back.
Well, I would argue that every U.S. president since Kennedy has been a puppet since the moment they started.
Yeah. And by the way, what Kennedy was doing, he was assassinated by the Jesuits, and what he was doing was he had signed, 10 days before his assassination, he had signed something called the Green Hilton Agreement. Hilton like the hotel. That was going to have U.S. dollars backed by gold and just throw the Fed out. And they couldn't have that, so they killed him instead. And this gold that was going to back the dollars when they were assassinating Kennedy, well, this gold has now been promised back to the United States. I'm in touch with the man who's got the signature authority. There's a lot of gold that people don't know about. There's 170,500 metric tons of gold in the vault of the Bank of Hawaii, and that's the gold that's there to back U.S. dollars. And by the way, there's uncut U.S. dollars. We just have to, as a people, tell those rotten banks that they are not allowed to, you know, to imprison our country any longer. We're taking our country back and we're taking our currency back. Very simple. And we're going to do that in very short order. Anyway, let me tell you about the rest of the gold. There's 130,500 metric tons in Amex Hong Kong. There's 150,000 metric tons in Development Bank of Singapore. That's a total of 451,000 metric tons. That's what? More than double the amount that people think is on, you know, existence. But I'm not finished. There's another 100,000 metric tons in other assorted American banks. And there's 172,000 metric tons buried in the Philippines. It's been reburied. They dug it up during World War II. there was Yamashita, that is a Japanese general. And the father of Yamashita is a guy who's descended from the brother of Queen Victoria. She had a twin, and they sent him off to the Philippines because he had, you know, Asperger's or something or other. The people in England didn't think he was going to make a suitable king. So he was sent off, but he, you know, he went around the world siring children. And guess who one of his kids was?
Oh, I don't know.
Hitler.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, but getting back to the gold. So this gold, at a certain point, it went to the Vatican. And people have been earning a lot of money on this wealth. You can imagine. And they've been having a field day with it. Everybody's been ignorant of it. But it's now, and it was there for the benefit of humanity. And those crooks have been using our gold for their benefit. They had no right to it.
Can we see that the gold standard might not work in terms
right,
of
and
a
I'm
economic
not talking about the gold standard, by the way. It can any it can be any commodity. It doesn't have to be a precious metal. For Ecuador, it can be bananas. It's anything of value.
Mm.
And the reason why we want to do that is because there should not be interest charged on countries' currency. And if it's supported by something, an asset, something of value, then the government just issues it and it's there. It's not people have to pay interest on it to bankers. That's the difference. It's very straightforward.
I spoke to Tom Filer, who works on Wall Street and sells commodities in a very honorable and transparent fashion in order to diversify people's gold and silver holdings with real commodities like land, food, etc. And what he told me is that 99% of the gold that's currently in circulation is just paper. It doesn't really exist. Is that true?
Yes, that's how they're keeping the price artificially low. They're doing something called naked shorting. They're manipulating the price of gold. But something, you know, the thing about gold is that it's got some very special characteristics, and there are economists that specialize in the monetary economics of gold. One of them is a man named Antal Feketa. He's a Hungarian, and he was the one that's pointed out in July 7th, central banks usually lease out their gold, and they stopped doing it because it was going to be too expensive. The lease price was too expensive because people were losing their faith in the paper dollars. And at a certain point, people who are holding gold will refuse to sell the gold for paper currency at any price. And we're getting close to that point.
What happens when that occurs to the global economy?
I can tell you. I used to be, I worked in Argentina. I worked for the U.S. Export-Import Bank before I came to the World Bank. And I was in Argentina in the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s. And what happens is the prices double overnight. And you have to keep adding zeros at the end of the currency. And you're just counting out dollar bills. You're just flipping through them, you know, to buy a banana. It's not a pleasant situation to be in when currency collapses. And we're very, very close to that with the dollars. If you look at a graph that I sent to – let me tell you, by the way, what our authorities know about this. They know everything about it. All of the governors of the 50 states – I've been writing to all of the attorneys general, and there's a special group of governors called the Council of Governors. My governor, Martin O'Malley, I live in Maryland, is one of the co-chairs, And so the other co-chair is Terry Branstad. And then the president of the National Governors Association is Jack Markell. He's from Delaware. He's on that council. I've been writing those guys. I've been telling them, and I just sent them a little graph showing how the dollars are about to collapse. And the countries of the world, by the way, they're refusing to accept dollars anymore. And the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, they are not using dollars when they trade among themselves. And if there's at the end of the accounting period, they're settling the difference in gold. So dollars are about to crash. There's no way that the Federal Reserve can do anything to prevent that. They're the ones that were causing it. And what they want is they want people to be panicked and go to their FEMA camps. They've been trying to do all kinds of stupid, they call them false flags, to panic people. And we have gotten ahead of them, and we've warned people. So Syria didn't happen. There was supposed to be an event on the 8th of October. There was a nuclear bomb that was all set to go off in Charleston. And two of the senior naval authorities made sure that the bomb detonated 600 miles off the coast of South Carolina. And they were fired for their trouble. But I'm just saying, this isn't working. So now the banksters have to come up with something. I think I was just listening on the radio. I think they're now trying to start a war with China. I mean, they're just clueless, these idiots. They are totally clueless. They're just like the wizard in The Wizard of Oz. Remember that little old wizened man in the projection booth?
Oh,
Frank
yeah.
Frank Baum, who wrote that story, was writing about monetary economics and wanted to put it that way. And I'll tell you, the World Bank whistleblowers are Toto, and we have pulled the curtain back. And you can see that little wizened old man and what he's doing. And he's the projection screen. That's the mainstream media that the banksters own and the Vatican owns. Yeah, but it's not
working. So can I ask, just clarification, those officials within the U.S. administration that know about the coming currency collapse, are they covering it up because they're too afraid that people will find out and it'll collapse sooner? Or are they covering it up because they don't want it to collapse just yet and they want all their power and control mechanisms in order to get people in the FEMA camps faster in place
first? No, you haven't figured out where we are on this. Where we are on this is that the coalition that I'm telling you about exists, and we have taken control. We have won. We've won. And now they're just sort of scrambling and going, blah, 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 blah. That's what they're doing. I mean, if you were in the control tower for these idiots, you could see they're trying to put out fires and running around like chickens without heads because we have won. We're the ones in control. I can show you the email that I sent to these idiots. No, the people are taking back all of their gold, and we're in charge. And, you know, in a matter of days. Because people understand what these thugs are, they see them, and there's nowhere for these idiots to go.
Well, I'd say nowhere. Some of the population certainly sees what's happening, but I fear that the bulk of the population are completely unaware of this entirely. And that's kind of includes myself.
Okay, let me tell you how it works, all right? This power transition model that I'm telling you about, it came out of the Department of Defense, right? Chuck Hagel was the senator of Nebraska in 2008. When I spoke to him about this model, I have the letter that I wrote to then the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, Charles Grassley, where I was describing my conversation with the Secretary of Defense. So I got in touch with the group. First I went to the Inspector General of the Department of Defense. And I said, you know, you've got a little problem going on here with the fact that you've got the Fed trying to ruin what is national security. We're going to lose NATO because this model is very accurate. I said, we're going to lose NATO. You had better get this corruption under control. You know that this transition power model is 90 to 95% accurate. You can see where we are. I said, here's my correspondence with all of the countries of the world. I've been on Russian television today three times. I've gotten all kinds of statements up in, there's a website in Germany which has 1.5 million readers per month. And in that interview that's up there, they were asking me about the military helicopter that buzzed the U.S. consulate in Frankfurt. They said, Karen, what does it mean? I said, I think you were trying to get our attention, aren't you? And I take that conversation and I give it to the Department of Defense. And I say, if you want NATO, you know what's good for you. You're going to kick out this stupid Federal Reserve. That's how this model works. Are you getting the picture?
Well, NATO appears to me to simply be the world army. Like, let's back up a little second here. So we've got this banking cartel that's currently trying to keep its agenda on track, and they're failing.
My fear is there is no agenda.
There's no agenda by the bankers to take over the world monetarily?
They would have been in control if their agenda was working. The BRICS countries said, no, we're not having a single currency. Forget it. Go take a hike. So that didn't work. Then they had this idea to have some kind of a martial law introduced. That didn't work. The bomb didn't go up. What, one of their stupid plans, they told all of the members of Congress to get on four military aircraft and fly to Florida for the funeral of one of the members of Congress. So we found out about it. There's a group called Able Danger. I mean, I've been working with all kinds of really fascinating groups. So Able Danger sent them a note saying, if you get on those planes, one of three things is going to happen. They're going to go to a prison and we're going to put all of the members of Congress in jail for being traitors. That's a possibility. The planes could fly to Guantanamo Bay. That's a possibility. They could also crash. So the members of Congress did not get on those planes. 30 of them did. That's all. We are foiling their attempts at, you know, it's just their business is not going as usual.
All right. We'll be right back after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. Gentlemen, to the show that is broadcasting somewhere over the horizon in New Zealand, and we're talking about the man behind the curtains. I think that's quite an appropriate song to have at this particular juncture. Now, what we were discussing over the break, Karen, was about how the White Hat Society, and I believe there was a whistleblower named Drake who came out earlier, it might have been last year or the year before, saying that they're going to overturn and expose the New World Order and that we're going to win and we're going to jail all the bankers. And there were two reactions from people, maybe three. Reaction number one, okay, great, it's all over. I don't have to do anything anymore because somebody's got it well in hand. Two, I don't believe it. It must be a scam to try and make us all stand down. Or three, hey, these people have really got something here. How can I help? How can I contribute to making my world less dominated by scumbaggery? I wanted to have this discussion with you upon these different perspectives here.
Well, yes, you can, but I'm going to ask for the prerogative of a guest. That was one of my favorite songs. Would you mind if I just sang a couple of bars from it?
Go for your life.
Birds fly over the rainbow. Why then, oh, why can't I? Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the birds are far behind me. Where troubles melt like lemon drops, away above the chimney tops, that's where you'll find me. Okay, that's enough.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know.
I could have sang for the rest of the night, but anyway, I'll spare your listeners. Okay, now, I was thinking about, as you were talking about that, I was thinking about the best way to describe it, to answer it. Think about a heart patient that just, you know, had a heart attack, was dragged into the operating room, had surgery, managed just barely to hang on, okay? That's where we're going to be once we get things straightened out with these bankers. Now, do you think we should, the people that are listening, we're all in this together. Do you think you can just sort of sit back while that poor, you know, next to a corpse is trying to recover? I mean, everybody's got to do their bit. And the thing is, we're not going to get it right because we have been in dire straits. I mean, just think about it. Think about all of the terrible food that we've been eating for all these years. I mean, think about the terrible inferior education we've been getting. Think about all the starving people in, you know, in various places. I mean, we have got to really, everybody's got to pitch in. And the hard part is that since we've been, you know, flailing around, being tormented by these you know, and we have to take our responsibility for it. I mean, have we been working hard to understand what's going on? Some of us have. I mean, I'll tell you, it's been amazing the way we've all been pulling together. But we've been doing the heavy lifting, and we could use some help.
What kind of help? I mean, because you use that analogy of the heart patient. A coronary surgeon has nurses and such, and he goes, scalpel, mop my brow, give me this this clamp that blood flow over there. I mean, what would you be directing the nurses to do right about now?
No, we are the patient.
The White Hat Society is the patient that needs our help?
I'm saying all of humanity is that patient.
Okay. But you're taking the spear tip straight into these people. So what is it that people can actually do to help you and the White Hats and the whistleblowers to further your cause?
Well, the very first thing is to start figuring out what part you've played in this whole drama. I mean, we've landed up on the operating table. We're not dead yet. And so everybody who's going to start pitching in to get the patient up and recovered, the first thing to do is to sit back and to figure out whether you were part of the disease or whether you were part of the group that was trying, you know, to get better. And be very candid with yourself, because if you're going to do something good going forward, you have to figure out where you were and what it is that you have to do differently. So the very first thing is, and don't do it by yourself, because nobody wants to be honest with himself. I mean, for me, the best way for me to be effective was I had to sit there and see where it was that I was just deluding myself. What difficult truths I was trying to avoid. And my sisters can tell you about those. You know, they weren't very pretty, and it wasn't very much fun for me to see myself as the person I really was. But luckily, you know, my sisters stuck with me and told me who I was and what I was doing wrong. And I, you know, I'll give myself credit. I did actually try to see what they were telling me and understand it. And once you go through that kind of a personal understanding, then you're not going to be duped by the next person that's telling you to do things that are really quite destructive to yourself. I mean, you don't want your world to be a terrible world for your children. And if you're one of those people who says, I could care less and I just want it here for me, I'm going to say something on this broadcast that I don't usually say. But I'm a person who was lucky enough to have, as one of my friends, a person who died and then didn't die. Bashir Sulal, he was run over, he had a motorcycle, he was run over, he died in the ambulance, and then he came back and he told me about it. So, you know, you've got nowhere to go. Just think about it.
Yeah, I think this is the reason why I do what I do with the shows and interviewing people like yourself, is because my theory is, if these people aren't stopped, these evil scumbags, I'm freaking dead. You're freaking dead. We're all freaking dead. They'll kill the whole world before they let loose their grip on power, unless we stop them. You know, I mean, I don't really see much of a choice in this. You know, what other career prospects have I got? Oh, I'm going to sell telecommunications. What, telecommunications for one of these giant New World Order companies that are going to be used to surveil all the people that you're selling the product to in exchange for thousands of dollars a month? No, I can't do that. I can, on the other hand, help people who need some coverage to get their ideas out there so that all of this corrupt system in its entirety gets exposed. Because it's not just the banking system. It's not just the medical system or the politicians. It's everything. It's the everything system. Everything everywhere seems to me to be totally fracked. So that means everybody everywhere needs to be doing their part in order to expose it, bring it to public consciousness, and then solve it. Right? There's not very much point in trying to solve a problem that you don't understand, but there's not very much point in trying to understand a problem that you're not trying to solve.
Yeah. Well, at this point, everybody, I think, is pretty much riveted to this recognition. That we are at the moment of recognition. Enough of us see what's going on. Enough of us are there to do that transformation, and that's where we're at. It's a very exciting moment. It's a wonderful moment. I think we should all relish it, you know, because we've actually, that's what I meant when I said we've won. No, we've got a lot of recovering to do. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying we are at the point where we all see where it is, or enough of us see where it is that we can show the rest of us. And that's what we have to do.
Yeah, you're right. And in fact, this has been something I've been saying for years, is that we've already won. We're simply going through the motions. The victory that we needed and the victory that we now are simply capitalizing on is a public awakening. And there is a big public awakening. That's what we needed to start happening in order to get our goals listened to and then indeed implemented. We couldn't actually do anything without this mass public awakening now. I mean, shows like mine exist because there's a mass public awakening and people are able to contribute. The White Hat Society exists because there's a public awakening and people actually understand the material that you're coming out. I mean, if you came out and tried to tell everybody this kind of stuff in, say, 1973, nobody would have any idea what you were were talking about, and you'd vanish into obscurity. But now you're catapulting into almost a version of underground superstardom because of the mass awakening.
Okay, let me tell you where I am on this. I am one of the surfers. We've been riding this curling wave. There's a whole slew of us, all of us, you know. And the ones that have been, you know, in the background but doing the heavy lifting know very, very well who they are. So, you know, it's been, and a lot of people have had to really, you know, pull me back from doing the wrong thing. It's been a group effort from, you know, soup to nuts.
Yeah. Well, I found that there's a lot of elders in this movement who have been exposing this kind of material for decades upon decades. Without their diligence in those early years, we wouldn't have anything to. We wouldn't even have any legs to stand on. We probably would be far, far back in the game at this particular point. And you do have to stand upon the shoulders of giants sometimes in order to touch the sky.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's important to pay homage, as often as is reasonable, to these people, because it's sort of like the Greatest Generation, who died in World War II so that we could have our freedoms preserved, allegedly, even though it was just kind of, you know, a staged war that wound up reducing the population and getting a whole bunch of very nasty banking and international governance measures like the UN and World Bank instituted. But at the end of the day, that belief was there that
Vinny,
those people
the World
died
Bank disabled. Has been a very important. If I wasn't able to go to all of those countries and contact them over a period of time, we wouldn't have a solution. I'm not saying that the World Bank has got to continue, but I'm saying that it is a platform that we can use to go forward with. You've got to convene the parties. You've got to prevent this gold backwardation. Do you see what I'm saying? I'm not saying that we want one currency in the world. Absolutely not. But I'm saying that if we don't have a place to convene all the parties so that they understand that this is a turning point and that there is a consensus for humanity to take back its own wealth, then we wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we need to get the discussion going, don't we? We need the discussion to continue.
It's the forum for the discussion. It's ours now. It's our institution. I've spoken to all the World Bank whistleblowers to ask them whether that place has got to be trashed or whether if we all went back as a group, if we could get that place to fly right enough so that we could move to the next thing that everybody wants. And everybody agrees, yes, it's something that's it's what you call the global public commons. If you didn't have those crooks intimidating everybody with their institutional integrity department, then people inside the place, if they felt comfortable blowing the whistle when things were going badly, you could get that thing straightened up enough so that you could get from point A to point B.
Mm. So at this particular point in time, I mean, what's your next move? Are you going to conferences or this kind of thing? Are you in a recruiting process? What?
Well, the number one thing that we all have to work on is getting the currencies functional. We have got to take the Federal Reserve notes and ignore them and issue dollars that are backed by this gold that the person who's got the authorized signatory power has given to us. We have to believe that it's there for us to use, and we've got to get that happening. That's very important. And what people who are listening to this can do is they can get, if they're American, they can get in touch with their county executives and have their county executives get in touch with their governors. And they can issue, they can have their states recognize gold and silver as currency.
All right. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen.
Right here, it's paradise. If you place a thing in the center of your life that lacks the power to nourish, it will eventually poison everything that you are and destroy you. As simple a thing as an idea or your perspective on yourself or the world. No one can be the source of your content. It lies within, in the center.
Only with mellow are you thinking that to slide through. Only with mellow are you thinking that to slide through.
Don't let nothing ride you.
If the sun or the moon should give way to die,
they would immediately go out.
One swallow don't make a summer,
but tomorrow has to start somewhere.
Newspapers entertain, lion tamers die in pain. This child, wise beyond words.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's the final segment here. It's been a very quick show. Karen, we've only got about 10 minutes left. I'd like to get some of your personal background. I mean, growing up as a child, did you think any of this kind of stuff would happen to you? Or did you think that the system was... the lie. Did you think that the lie about the system being good and being there for everybody was true for a period of time?
Well, you know, my parents knew that they were in for it with me. As a little baby, as soon as I could stand up, they called me Mussolini because I would just go on and on, you know, like I have tonight, just giving speeches. That was what I did in my crib. And I have to tell a story. I had a really great family life. I mean, my parents are really great. And my father was a small businessman. He had a grocery store, and he would take me to his store, and I would be a cashier. And when I was four or something, he did something I didn't like, and I didn't really know what to do, but I was very, very angry. And I hauled off, and I socked him where it hurt. He knew he was in for trouble with me then. I mean, I really hurt him. I was really mad. And something gave me the idea that that was the way to make my point. So, yeah. But, I mean... I was captain of the NYU fencing team. I have never been a shrinking violet. I mean, that's just my nature. And when things happened that I didn't like, I was not afraid to let people know. So, you know, and the 60s, that was a perfect time if that's the kind of person you were to be involved in that.
Well, I think it was the opportune moment, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. I was just talking to my mother. She's going to be 90, and she was going on. She's now in an assisted living facility, and she was complaining about some of the hairdos. And I said, "Ma, you forgot what I used to do. I had an Angela Davis wig."
I'm not even familiar with Angela Davis. See, I wasn't even conceived back in the 60s.
Okay, well,
hey,
Google Angela Davis. And you'll see what kind of wig I had.
Somebody tells me this will be a very shocking one. Yeah. Hey, isn't it funny how fashions change, eh? And I find it's like, though, the more things change. Oh, my God, that's an Angela Davis wig? Me? Jesus. That's like the biggest afro I've ever seen. That's like the death row of afros, bro.
That's what I used to wear.
I mean, as the gays would say, that's out of control.
That's right.
Well, I'm glad to see that you haven't changed much.
That's right.
Well, see, this is another thing as well. I'm glad to see that you're still having fun with all of this because you're dealing with some of the most serious scum that this earth has ever seen. And how are you keeping your sanity amidst all of this? How are you preventing yourself from becoming paranoid?
Because I'm surrounded by wonderful people.
Is that it?
Yeah.
I guess that's pretty straightforward, hey? Because if you've got good reinforcing energy and good reinforcing people around you at all times, you can never be isolated. And as far as I know, that's how psychopaths really treat their victims, is in order to victimize them properly, you need to get them isolated away from anybody who would help them or give them emotional support or anything like that. So you've kind of thwarted them in that perspective.
Well, look what they've done with putting some of the prisoners in solitary confinement.
Yeah, that's true. I think Dean Clifford has been arrested again. And last time he was arrested, they kept him in solitary confinement for a number of months, to the point where even the guards started to feel sorry for him. And they come up trying to talk to him in the cell. It's like, hey, man, are you okay? Do you need anything? He's like, no, I'm good. Bugger off. It's just like you realize soon enough, and it doesn't matter how many bad things are planned to, shall we say, detach you from your sanity, detach you from your humanity. If you don't give up, and if you simply dig your heels in, there's very little that can stop you achieving your objectives, is there?
Yeah.
Now, if we're going to take out these bankers, what would you suggest would be the appropriate punishment? Because every crime deserves some form of punishment. Would you agree?
I was talking to some people about that, and I was saying that, to me, probably the best punishment is to let them walk down the street and have people look at them and know who they are.
I recall when I was a child, I had a whole group of kids attack me. I think I had like about maybe 10 kids trying to beat me up, and I bit one of them, and it scared them all off. You know, they went running. And said, oh my God, this boy is biting us! And so they all went off and complained to the principal. And this is a Catholic school, and the principal hung a sign around my neck that said "dog bite," and marched me through the school while the whole school made fun of me. That wasn't a very nice experience. It'd be nice to see that happen to a banker.
Yep.
Yeah. Sign around their neck that says banker. I mean, do you remember that movie Braveheart where William Wallace was being trundled into the square where he was about to be tortured and killed, and people threw rotten fruits and vegetables at him of some kind? I think that could actually be quite a cathartic experience, you know? I think you would just imagine, you know, a tomato squelching on the side of David Rockefeller's head. Mm-hmm. Maybe a can of beans or something here or there. You know, nobody knows. But, yeah. Anyway, coming down to the last of it, do you have any final pieces of advice for anybody who's currently in your position to garner other whistleblowers to come forward? But to come forward in such a way that they're actually protected and don't become the victims of the system that they're trying to expose.
But, you know, most of the best advice to whistleblowers is don't become a whistleblower because it's not for the faint-hearted. But I think now that we've succeeded in exposing these, you know, banking practices, I think the main thing is for people to protect their whistleblowers. Yeah, because you need to know what's going on, and that's really the only way to find out is for people on the inside to tell you. And if they're going to tell you, you have to protect them.
How does one go about protecting a whistleblower? I mean,
we're not doing such a good job of it. Look what's happening to Beverly Manning. Yeah, I mean, you have to make it clear that you find it unacceptable for people who give you information that you need to know, for those people to be retaliated against and punished. In the case of the World Bank whistleblowers, the U.S. Congress has passed legislation that says that the U.S. contribution to the capital increase will not be dispersed until the effects of retaliation against whistleblowers have been eliminated. So the Congress did its part. But that's not getting enforced. Yeah, it's not getting enforced. It needs to be. And we whistleblowers at the World Bank need to go back and, you know, straighten up that place and get things rolling for the rest of the world. And we, what we have is we have the countries of the world that are sitting there that can, you know, you can hold your politicians to account in each country that's listening to this broadcast. You know, I've, if you want to know what I wrote to your executive director on the board, I can tell you I've been writing these guys, you know, since 2004. And lately I've been writing them, you know, 2-3 times a month, sometimes more often when they need it, than cheering them on.
It's kind of like when you were saying that, I sort of thought for a moment that you were writing constant letters to the directors of reserve banks all around the world. And it's not, but it kind of reminded me of The Shawshank Redemption. Have you seen that movie?
No, I didn't. No, I'm not writing the private bankers. I'm writing the ones inside the World Bank whose job it is to clean up the world.
Yeah.
Well, and protect the bondholders who own World Bank bonds. See, that's where I've got the law in every single country of the world, because the World Bank has sold $180 billion worth of bonds. That's the law that I'm getting everybody to enforce.
Well, I'm very glad that you are doing the work you're doing, Karen. And if you keep sending those letters constantly, eventually it'll sink in, and they'll do what you want them to do and ask you to please stop sending us letters.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
All right. Harassment by mail does work, ladies and gentlemen. Don't disparage it. Thank you, Karen. It's been lovely. And do you have a website, just quickly?
Yes. KAHUDES.net. And thanks for having me, Vinny.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been my honor, pleasure, and various other nice adjectives, too. And we'll see you again sometime, Karen, and we'll see you again sometime, too. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening.
Thank you.